Good Friday morning, folks. If it's 11, it's and you're listening to CQW 95.9 FM, your community radio station, right here at University of Winnipeg. And if it is that time, and if you're listening, you're listening to Have No Fixed Address with your host, Al Weeb. That is my new theme song, so you're going to hear it every single week at the start of the show. And I picked that one because it shows commitment, and it shows my commitment to the folks out there who are still, unfortunately, living on our street in 2022, which is really, really a sad reflection of our society. And I just think it's a really appropriate song to carry on the show. And today, I have a very special guest on. And we're just getting some microphones ready here. My guest today is Sean Loney, a person who has decided to throw his hat into the ring and run for the mayor of our city. And, you know, we need really, really strong candidates. And I know Sean is one of them, and he has some really great experience leading into this this election year, and I think he'd be a really great great mayor for our city. That being said, now first of all, I have to say it's going to be warm today, plus 27. So if you are going to Tim's, actually just buy an extra iced coffee or buy a bottle of water for somebody. Don't make the folks on the sidewalk invisible. They're going to be suffering today, so do what you can. You know, I live right across the street from Central Park, and I see many vulnerable folks out in Central Park sitting around the benches, and most of them are really suffering. So be kind, try to drop some empathy, and do what you can. I always say that you can never do too little and you can never do too much. But don't make people invisible. Offer a kind word. It gives them a degree of dignity and a feeling that somebody actually considers them worth talking to. Folks, again, today, Sean Loney on sitting across from me in the studio. It's only the second time I've had a guest in the studio since COVID ended. Mm. So we're really fortunate to have you. Sean, how are you?
Good, Al. And nice to be together. And what a lovely choice for a theme song. It really places us in relationship to each other in the city. And just really been looking forward to our chat this morning.
Yeah, me as well. It's been coming for a couple of weeks. And we did actually meet twice prior to this. Mm-hmm. Once was at Exchange one evening there when you had a little bit of a film. And then again, we spoke earlier at the Forks one time. And it was a real pleasure meeting you then. And since then, I've been wanting to have you on the air and get your perspective on things that are going on in the city. Could you just start out by giving me or giving our listeners just a little bit of a bio or a little bit of history of Sean Loney? I know you go back quite a ways in this business, and probably a dozen years from when I understand, you know, when you started with Build. But, you know, just give our listeners a little bit of who Sean Loney is.
Yeah, sure, Al. It's nice to have a bit of time to get to know each other on the air here. I grew up actually in northwestern Ontario, and the reason why I wanted to start with that is because this little town called Emo, and it's right close to the Rainy River First Nations. And my family owned a grocery store, and when I reflect back on my growing up, I realize the main block of customers at the grocery store were from the Rainy River First Nations. And I begin a conversation with myself, I think, about how poverty and privilege are actually interconnected. You can't have one without the other. Mm-hmm. And I think my life and my career is very much revolves around trying to figure out my privilege, just knowing where it comes from and how it is connected with the poverty of others, and it really comes to play here in Winnipeg for me in many ways.
Yeah, I never thought about poverty and privilege being connected, but you can't have one without the other. You really can't.
Yeah, it's been a realization for me. And as you referenced, I've been 2006, I left working at the government. I was a senior civil servant, and with many other kind people in the community, we co-founded a nonprofit called Build.
Yes.
B-U-I-L-D. And it, it's been my faculty, really. It, this is what the community interacting with me and others as to what colonization looks like on the streets. And me and my family, or my family and I, we have easy access to the labor market. And I just realize there's so many people in Winnipeg that really want to work and don't have access to the labor market. And Build, it started out insulating low-income housing, but hiring people with barriers to employment, particularly people with criminal records, but others as well. And as I reflect back, I realize I think Winnipeg's defining issue is our ability to connect the people who most need the work with the work that most needs to be done. And so we've had some exciting strategies around social enterprise that I'd love to talk with you about this morning. But I also think there's just this huge interaction and carryover between these tools and how nonprofit sectors relating to government and how we can actually address homelessness in the city. And I've followed your work for years, Al, and your compassion and voice for people on the streets in Winnipeg. And I just think it's high time that Winnipeg becomes a leader and be known around the world for the city that addressed homelessness and provided people compassion and kindness, a warm place to live, which is what we really want for everyone.
Oh, you know, and that, that's, I have a difficult time when people say we're going to end homelessness because it's too difficult a task. And I've taken heat over that one, but I would say, okay, if we could end it, why haven't we done it 10, 15, 20 years ago and saved hundreds of thousands of lives? I think what we can do is reduce it. Mm-hmm. We can maintain where we're at and perhaps reduce it. I think the way things are now, we just simply don't have the willpower, maybe that's or the political will to do it. We don't have the resources. The federal government doesn't have the resources. All three levels of government need to be working together in a proper order, and right now we don't have a lot of that. It's becoming more and more prevalent with the, Rabbit Housing Initiative and the federal government working with the city on that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But somewhere or another, provinces and the city are always not on the same page on a lot of things. And
yeah, so let's share my perspective on that. I think the word I like to use is address homelessness.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I guess I would challenge the notion that there isn't resources. Mm-hmm. There are resources. We're spending them responding to the problem. And I think there's one thing everyone agrees to, whether you're conservative, liberal, green, NDP, federal, provincial, municipal, and that is this, that managing this problem is and responding to people in perpetual crisis over and over and over again, and responding through police, fire, ambulance, courts, jails, legal aid, healthcare, the cost of those embedded in those systems of responding is far more than the cost of resolving homelessness in the first place. And so I think it's critical we have new tools, systemic tools that lean into the fact that this is not a money issue. This is a systems issue.
Well, you're familiar, I know you are, with the Housing First concept.
Absolutely,
and At Home Chez Soi.
Yeah.
And I was a guinea pig for that one. And I also, became a case manager and served in five different areas in the Housing First. And that the Housing First program proved in that five-year study, or I think it went actually went for around 6 years, showed that it is cheaper. I mean, we can save money by actually servicing people, getting them off the street and servicing them rather than leaving them to ambulatory care and hospitalization and police, incarceration and all that kind of thing. That costs roughly, 23% more than it does to leave people and than to actually house people and give them supports.
And that's on an average.
Yes.
So, but just imagine the cohorts of people that are most in contact with emergency services. That the hard financial proposition is even greater, and so I think that our sector, and I'm saying the nonprofit sector now, you and I both hovering in there.
That's a good word.
Yeah, we've been asking governments to spend more on this issue for 30 years, mm-hmm. and now it's time we mm-hmm. step up and say, we need you to spend less, because the value proposition is so much better of providing supportive housing, the mm-hmm. compassion and kindness, than it is responding. So that's sort of step number one. And step number two, which is what I've learned from Build, is that governments value what they buy. And they don't value what they fund in the same way. And so governments use this procurement tool all the time. Mm-hmm. And I guess what we're proposing in this campaign is a new way of nonprofits to relate to all these different emergency service providers. And that is to say to them, we want to compete, actually. Mm-hmm. We want to compare the cost of staff time, the value in staff time of your agency, say, for example, the Winnipeg Police, mm-hmm. responding to a particular group of people over and over and over again. And let's compare that to what the nonprofit sector, what supportive housing can provide, and choose the one that makes the most sense from a public safety perspective and also from the perspective of from a financial perspective, mm-hmm. and we'll find that for most of the people living on the streets now, mm-hmm. that it is much more cost effective, much better for public safety, and for ambulance response times, for example, to allow these emergency service providers to engage nonprofits in a new way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it makes serious sense, and it just does go back to the at home is what
sure does.
It reflects that work there, which it's not the perfect model, but it's the absolute best model I think that we've ever had, as far as
I think that there could be some more. Nonprofits need some more flexibility to customize solutions for people,
but absolutely.
What we're pitching does allow for that. But in the end, I just want to affirm what you've been saying about At Home Chez Soi. Mm-hmm. The whole value proposition embedded in supportive housing, it's the most studied issue mm-hmm. in the history of our country. So
I worked at U of W. I know the research
on it. Yes. So I would challenge anyone to come forward and say, no, what we're doing now, sending fully armed police officers to mm-hmm. Wellness checks for people living in bus shelters that and the associated court appearances, the nights in jail, the mm-hmm. time in shelter, the visits to the emergency ward at the hospital, the nights in mental, that is more in fact, I'll state clearly that we would be hard-pressed to design a more expensive, less effective way to respond to this issue than what we're doing right now.
Yeah, I would have to agree with that. If we're just slipping away for just a second into the bus shelter issue, which mm-hmm. is a huge, besides the camps, the bus shelters are number one on everybody's mind when it comes to, city matters, it seems, these days. We had two city councilors and a service provider talk about removing bus shelters just to get the folks that were inhabiting the bus shelters mm-hmm. Out of them. That's obviously not a good solution. But as nobody really has a solution, my solution is we need more service provision or more outreach workers visiting those shelters and making sure that things are...
Or let's go one further step, and I would like to make an observation about that whole debate, is that no one was asking how much money and how much staff time, what is the value of staff time that the fire response, the paramedic response, mm-hmm. the police response, all these different systems, no one asked that question. Because I think that the folks saying, well, we want to take the bus shelters down, mm-hmm. they would agree with the folks like you and I saying that that's not the right issue, they would agree that what we need is more supportive housing, more customized solutions.
Absolutely.
And the great news is that that is cheaper than the value of staff time responding. And so I don't know that this is an issue of political will as much as it is we're stuck using old tools. I don't think Heather Stephenson, the Premier of Manitoba, likes homelessness. I think she'd like to do something. I don't think Brian Bowman, you know, I know it's on his heart that he wishes something more could be done, but we need new financial tools, and we're pretty excited last week and appreciate your support of the approach is to let's switch things up here and let's have nonprofits and these emergency service providers engaging each other in a new way.
And you know, they are doing that. You know, I'm on a lot of those committees, and you know, we are we have several committees in support of Unsheltered Winnipeggers, and the police and the fire department are involved in those committees, right?
Mm-hmm.
They are, and things are changing. They're shifting a little bit in that direction. And you know, with the poverty reduction strategy with the city, which I was very, very happy to be a core, you know, team member of working on that, albeit it wasn't without a fight to get there. You know, I'm always putting lived experience on the front burners all the time, but we did manage to do that. And you know, the oh god, just lost my train of thought.
Well,
here for a second.
I want to be able to say that you're right. There's lots that we're doing that's working really well.
Yeah, we have the city has added a housing worker to the city's or housing director to the city.
So there's lots that's happening that's working. Mm-hmm. I guess I would just make the case that it's all project based. It's not systemic, and so now we need to take the learnings from all the 1,000 pilot projects we've done. And say, we've created a system, and I think it's important. Winnipeg needs to turn the corner and realize that poverty isn't about poor people. Mm. It's about the failure of the systems that they're interacting with.
It is.
And how exciting it is that we have created a system that is really bad, and so really bad outcomes. Mm. So we can also create systems that really lean into love and compassion and see what love and compassion can do.
Yeah, and you know, our current and outgoing mayor, I truly believe he's got a good heart for the business. I truly believe he wants, because he did make a statement that he wished during his tenure he could have done more for the homeless. Mm-hmm. That was the one statement that stood out for me.
Yeah,
that you know, people are handcuffed and things, but you know, the city does have resources in the Winnipeg Housing Authority, and there are ways and means of working with that sector, I think, and we have the city's got land that can be developed, and I know they were giving away parcels of land for $1 not that long ago to build. Hopefully, you know.
Well, I think I'd like what I'd like to do, Al, is just kind of go over the three steps of what we're proposing.
Absolutely,
because it's different than than some of the tools, good tools, which you're mentioning. Mm-hmm. So, because I think the resources, we need to keep doing what we're doing as a baseline.
But build on it.
And then over above that, to number one, three steps is to ask all of these emergency service providers to make lists of the folks that they see all the time.
Yeah.
Number one. They've not been asked to do that before. Number two, really important, is please tell us the value of the staff time that is being used now to respond to those same people over and over and over again. It's shockingly predictable.
It's got to be extremely high.
It is. And the data we know from At Home Chez Soi is there. But these emergency service providers also keep track of this.
Well, sure they do.
And the third thing is then to make that information public and invite the nonprofit sector to say, you know what, we would like you to consider what we can do to reduce that workload. And if we reduce that workload, will you pay us after that workload is reduced? Mm-hmm. It's a simple three-step process. And so what that does is it moves us out of talking about Winnipeg Regional Health Authority or Manitoba Housing or vacant units. All of those things are really important. Tax increment financing, great tools.
Yeah.
But these three steps, Al, give us access to the police budget, the justice budget,
yep,
and the health budget in a way that those three systems will be happy, because they're going to have net cost reductions and they'll free them up to do the job that we want them to do and that mm-hmm. they want to do. Mm-hmm. And that to me is really exciting.
Yeah, it's, you know, the health authority spends a lot of money on yeah. on the homeless issue. You know, I work with on the community advisory board,
right?
With and we see all these things, and we know what the money that's being spent. And you know, Shannon Watson, who's a good friend, is responsible. You know, for a lot of the numbers that we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. You know, she goes over those things, but you know, they do spend a great deal of money on the homeless issue, and in case management of those folks.
Yeah. So a couple points. So first of all of these systems, when they're trying to do something around interventions, mm-hmm. the systems, the money systems are telling them that it's costing money.
Yeah.
And it's actually saving money. And so isn't that an exciting concept that we can now move, and our campaign is embedded in this, mm-hmm. to say, supportive housing mm-hmm. does not cost money.
No, it does.
It saves money.
It saves money, absolutely.
And so we need to stop asking government to spend more money.
You know, and the problem is I think the government's too short-sighted on this thing. Yes, it's going to save money over the long run, you know, not necessarily even over that long a run, but it's been proven over and over that money is saved.
Okay, but there's something embedded in there, which is to say we want to go to what's happening now is that our sector is going to government and saying, mm-hmm. look, there's a great value proposition here. Mm-hmm. Spend more now and you'll save more later. Yeah. That's not what I'm saying at all.
Yeah.
I'm saying attach a value to the staff time you're putting into responding now mm-hmm. and pay the nonprofit sector to reduce that. And I want to make 2 points. So first of all, around the value proposition, in the United States, hospitals are building housing for people who are homeless mm-hmm. in every state, Al. And they're doing it based on one outcome. And that outcome is that in some of these emergency wards, 30% of the people presenting there are homeless. Mm-hmm. And so they...
Can you imagine the cost of that?
Exactly. So, but the value proposition is there in the U.S. to build housing for people who are homeless, mm-hmm. either to reduce the number of visits to the emergency ward yeah. or if they are in hospital to be able to discharge them more quickly.
Yeah.
But what I really want to talk about is why is it that when if you're Indigenous or representing someone who's homeless mm-hmm. or women or refugees or First Nations, all of these things, why is it that when we go to government, government says, oh, we've got some funding for you. Mm-hmm. But when business goes to government, it's not. They don't use funding. They use procurement relationships. And that, this is the real difference.
I know all about procurement.
Yeah. So let's look at how the difference between when government procures a business to build a bridge, for mm-hmm. example. So there's a document that a contract.
Yeah.
And the contract says, look, government says in the contract, we're expecting a bridge that's, 100 meters long. Mm-hmm. It's got to hold this much weight. You know, you got to meet these timelines, all these things. And if and when you do that, we will pay you for that outcome. And so the contractor builds the bridge. Sometimes they're usually subcontracting mm-hmm. to other contractors.
Right. Yep.
When the bridge is built, the government inspector comes along and she's got a checklist. Check, check, mm-hmm. check. Mm-hmm. Yeah, here's your check. Mm-hmm. Away you go. Thank you very much. But if it's a nonprofit, just listen to the difference as how the government engages with nonprofits. Mm-hmm. This is like colonialism 101. Mm-hmm. So it's like, well, first of all, we have to agree in a budget up front. And just so you know, we're only going to pay you 10% of the value of what it is that you're doing. Mm. Number two, you can't divert from that budget unless you get our permission. Number three, you have to show us all your receipts. And number four, you can't have any money left over afterwards.
That's true. Yes.
So that...
It's called slippage.
Well, sure.
And give it to somebody else.
And so why don't we bring the procurement relationship that works so well, that governments spend $50 to mm-hmm. $75 billion a year procuring goods and services.
Yeah.
bring it into the nonprofit sector. We're not saying to nonprofits, we want you to be businesses. We're saying we want you to continue providing love and compassion, mm-hmm. but we want you to get paid for the value of your work. And government desperately needs that, because this is how we're going to reduce the pressure on the emergency services. Mm-hmm. This is how mm-hmm. we're going to address homelessness. Yeah. And that, to me, is a pretty exciting proposition.
I know the vast difference between one and the other. Being vice chair of CAB, we have the proposals come in, you know, once, twice a year.
Right.
And we have... You know, that's the good thing about being on CAB. You see how things are operating, and I know exactly what you're talking about. You have to use this money. If you don't, it goes back into the pot and goes to somebody else.
Right.
Or wherever it's best needed. And, I think that's probably a really, really good idea, a different way of looking at
things.
Well,
and the relationship is about compliance.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
not about the outcome.
No.
And so this...
That's exactly it.
And so if supportive housing providers are paid for their outcomes, their impact on... If police can pay for the impact on their own system, mm-hmm. why wouldn't they do that? If the healthcare system can pay for the workload reduction, the reduction in number of visits to mm-hmm. emergency ward, if the justice system can pay for a reduction in court appearances and a reduction in nights in jail, all of these things, they desperately need that. Mm-hmm. But we're stuck in these colonial relationships. And how we see this, and I've written about this in many ways, we've mm-hmm. gathered elders from across the mm-hmm. country mm-hmm. working with Raven Indigenous Capital Partners. And elders reminded us that the success of the pre-contact societies mm-hmm. we're based on one central economic fact, and that is that solutions were valued. It's yeah. not more complicated than that. If we value solutions, Winnipeg can show mm-hmm. the rest of the world how we go about addressing homelessness.
Yeah.
It does not cost more money. It actually saves money.
It does.
And these procurement relationships also, for the very first time, would connect struggling emergency service mm-hmm. providers to solutions. Because right now, the police are about law enforcement. Mm-hmm. They don't have a mandate to be spending money on supportive housing.
No, of course not.
And so...
That's not their job.
No, it isn't. And we want to free them up to yeah. focus on actual criminals, which is
yeah.
most of their workload is not and directed I think, in that
and
way.
Again, I know you have quite a bit to say on the police... system. I know we talked a little bit about that. Mm-hmm. But folks, you're listening to CQW 95.9 FM, your community radio station on right here at the University of Winnipeg. And your temperature right now is 26, going up to 27 or 28. Be kind. Humidity in Winnipeg is always high in the summer, and when it's 26, it feels like, generally speaking, roughly 30 or 32, 33. So make sure you're doing the right thing and offering something to the folks that you see out there. We're just going to take a brief music break and come back with my very special guest, Sean Loney, and talking about what his vision for the city. And stay tuned. Back in about 3. folks. We're back. CQW 95.9 FM, your community radio station right here at the University of Winnipeg. Live and in studio and in person. And hopefully COVID doesn't turn things sideways or upside down again anytime soon. We know it's probably going to happen at one point or another, but let's hope it doesn't happen too soon. And let's hope it's not too serious so we can stay doing what we're doing here. And it's 26 again, as I said, and going up to about 28, so be kind. And just think, if you had to spend, you know, you say that's not too bad. Yeah, but what if you had to spend 24/7 out there? Whether it was plus 26 or minus 35 or even 10 degrees and humid. Think about it. Today, my guest is Sean Loney, candidate for mayor of our city, and very happy to have you back on, or have you on today, and talking about issues of the city. And we spend a good deal of time on housing, which is in particular a big interest for me as I've come through the Housing First program, and we kind of define, you know, the cost of leaving the way things are as compared to doing it with through supportive housing. That the cost difference is huge, and we did a 5-year study on it, but then kind of dropped the ball on that. And sure, some programs are shadows of what At Home Safe are still now, but they're not the same. They're running programs.
Yeah,
here
we had Aldis 5-year conclusive study, which supported the findings of similar studies from all around the world.
Yep.
To say, government, you should spend more money on supportive housing, and you'll see it'll save money in the long run. And I think that we need new tools.
Yep.
We need to connect nonprofit supportive housing providers to emergency service
yes.
providers.
Yep.
And really have that comparison between love and compassion, mm-hmm. what it costs,
yep.
and the outcomes versus business as usual.
Yep.
And let's have a competition between those two.
And you know, business as usual isn't doing the job.
No.
It is not doing the job.
And we need to alert taxpayers to the amount of money that
yes.
that we're spending.
Oh, you know, that's entirely true. You know, and that one will turn some minds, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Because everything's about, you know, taxpayers are worried about their property taxes going up all the time. Where's that money going?
Well, the city's own data mm-hmm. shows that in the last 15 years, the growth in city spending on a real per capita basis,
yeah.
all of it has gone to emergency services, all of it. Interesting, isn't it?
Yes.
That at the same time, the homelessness problem has increased.
Yes, it has.
And I would say one is following the other.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way out of this mess is to reduce the workload on emergency service providers. And that's a unique perspective that we're bringing to the municipal election.
Right now, actually, the workload on service providers is pretty heavy. And you know, you're absolutely right that we need to reduce that. I want to get into one thing that we briefly touched on, and that is BUILD,
right.
organization that you founded way back in a dozen years ago.
No, 2006, yeah, co-founded with a lot of others.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, and yeah, but that's what, 14 years ago?
Maybe more than that, Al. 15, 16, maybe? I think.
Yeah.
2006, 16 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah,
we've learned a lot in that amount of time.
And right about that time, I was experiencing homelessness.
Mm.
And, actually, in 2010, I actually started, you know, it's roughly around, in 2010, I ended up on the streets. And, but, you know, I know I got involved later on with the At Home Safe Spot program.
Mm-hmm.
I was actually not randomly selected for housing when they pushed that button.
Right.
When I was at Salvation Army.
I've heard about this button. Brutal.
Yeah. And, I at that time thought it was a conspiracy. Why do they want to keep me in Salvation Army for a lot longer? Anyway, I know that, you know, I got to know the familiar with the term, with the organization BUILD, and I learned to become friends with a person named Lindsay Stewart who works with you on your campaign, and she's mm-hmm. a wonderful, wonderful advocate.
She is.
And ally, has been ally. And Talk to me a little bit about build. I know some of the things, one of the things today that's so terribly important, and it seems like a small thing, but it's not. It's a huge thing. And that is, even today, you know, I'm not sure they're still doing it, but I know last year they were, or recently, is getting manageable ID for folks that don't have any. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the homeless, that's one of the big barriers to people experiencing homelessness is having an ID. They may have had some at some point in time, but things get lost when you're on the street.
Sure.
You know, you need ID for almost anything. And mm-hmm. so, you know, Bill is one of those organizations that was helping folks get ID. And I know I referred people to you, to the organization when I was a case manager. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, talk to me a little bit about build and also purposeful.
I guess I first want to say that for a lot of folks, because your listeners are tuning in around the issue of homelessness,
right.
I'm not suggesting that we, you know, go and directly employ people who are on the street now. I am suggesting, though, that we see the potential in each other.
Yep.
And the first step for people is stabilization in a warm, compassionate home with customized wraparound supports.
Yep.
But there's an awful lot of people, whether it's a second step or whether people are ready now, mm-hmm. who really want to work. Mm-hmm. But the private sector isn't a good fit for them. First of all, they might not get through the interview process.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, yeah, I've got a lengthy criminal record.
You know, that's the thing, too, is not only because they may have a criminal record, but because they don't have the people skills to get through an interview.
Exactly.
And because of trauma, for one.
Sure.
It's hard to gather two thoughts together in an articulate manner when you're really suffering through trauma.
Sure. You don't have the right clothes. You don't have the work experience
right.
on a resume. You don't have the reference. You don't have a driver's license, grade 12 math. All of these things add up, but does that mean we should write people off? No. So Build really looks to hire people that other employers wouldn't, and just mm-hmm. to see the potential in each other.
Yeah.
And I think this is so exciting for Winnipeg is that, wow.
It is.
Wouldn't it be amazing if instead of you're judging each other for where we're at is to see each other's potential. So
yes, and you know, one of the things I speak on all the time and is looking beyond that person in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
What did they do in the past? Using those skills and put them to work.
Right.
Or use them in some form or fashion. When I do my peer engagement training, that is one of the things I bring up all the time. You know, don't look at that person and gather judgment.
Right.
We don't gather judgment anyway. That's not what we do. But don't do that. You know, look beyond or look past to that person past them. What skills did that person have before?
Love that point, Al.
Know? And so that's what you're doing.
And Lucas Stewart, who I've worked with since 2006 on these things, and he was reflecting one time he was hiring somebody that had been selling a lot of drugs.
He's got sales ability.
Exactly. Yeah, Lucas was saying, wow, you're probably pretty good at sales. Yeah. Probably pretty good at money collection. Is like,
When you
say you're going to do something, you're actually going to do it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, but I think the important thing about build and purpose construction, Aki Energy and Aki Foods, is that it's not just me seeing and others like me mm-hmm. seeing the potential in folks that have had a very different background. They're seeing the potential in me. Mm-hmm. And here I am in your studio. I'm a very privileged, white, straight, mm-hmm. well-educated man. Mm-hmm. And so what a feeling of grace to be recognized as a human being by people who have had it pretty tough. And so mm-hmm. that...
It takes a lot to get there, though.
Well, sure, but I just find there's folks that are present themselves at Build, and I find all of Winnipeg could learn something from them seeing potential in me. And I'm grateful for that. So we're located at the Social Enterprise Center, and I encourage your listeners mm-hmm. to, if you're going north on Main Street, you go underneath the underpass.
It's that big red building.
Yeah, and you see Mother Earth Recycling on the right, and Jessica Floresco is co-chairing my campaign. Mm. So this idea of connecting the people who most need the work with the work that most needs to be done is very embedded. And in behind Mother Earth Recycling is a 30,000 square foot facility that the rest of the country is watching, and it's a place where people can be connected to employment because they have no driver's license, because they have no work experience or criminal record.
You know, I really give you kudos for that, because it doesn't happen. Yeah. What you're doing is unusual. It's just not people haven't come to the – again, this is the stigma – what you're is destigmatizing these people.
Right.
And what is the greatest barrier, and one another thing that I train on all the time, is destigmatizing and getting rid of unconscious biases and biases. And so what you're doing is doing that. You are destigmatizing these people and enabling them to move forward. And the greatest casualty, I say this over and over and over again, the greatest casualty of homelessness, besides loss of life, and there, as we know, there's lots and lots and lots of death out there, but the greatest casualty besides that is the loss of dignity, self-respect, self-confidence,
Absolutely.
And self-worth. And what you're doing is putting people who need these things back in their life. You're helping to put those things back in their life. And people, I speak from total experience here. It took me 6 years after I escaped the streets to get my anything near where I was prior to.
Mm.
You know, now, you know, 10 years later, I'm back, and I'm stronger than ever before. But it takes a long time to get there, and you also need people like yourself doing these things. And people, just listen to this, because this is really, really important. It takes years to get that back. But when you will give people who have experienced homelessness or great trauma in their lives, or even through mental health, to give them the opportunity to use the skills that they have to do something beneficial and positive is something huge. And you can't put enough money into that. You can't put enough. I can't explain how important that really, really is.
Well, we can imagine a future in Winnipeg, Al, where the Winnipeg police are paying Build, Purpose Construction, and so many others for the value of the workload reduction.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been to Scotland a couple times. There's 5,600 social enterprises in Scotland, a very disruptive business model. 5,600. If we had that many in Winnipeg, it would be 800.
Wow.
And
how many do we have? 30?
Maybe, yeah. And they're all struggling because they're not – well, I shouldn't say struggling. I mean, they're successful, but they could be much more successful if they were paid the value of the work.
Right.
Not just drywalling or insulating, but the reduction in workload across these systems. Mm-hmm. And in Scotland, half of these 5,600 social enterprises are led by women, which I find fascinating. Two-thirds of them hire people with barriers to employment.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And the average CEO makes 2.5 times as much as the average worker. And Canada's top employers, they don't hire people with barriers to employment. They average CEO makes 209 times as much as the average worker before stock options.
Yeah.
And two out of those 100 companies are led by women. So I was on a bus in Scotland, and in Glasgow, actually, and I was asking the bus driver, is this the way to – I was going to go visit this social enterprise. And and he spoke back to me. I couldn't understand what he was saying because it was this hard Scottish. And
I
did the old, you know, put my hand behind my ear and said, oh, I'm sorry, I'm hard of hearing kind of thing. He said again, I don't know, I can't understand him. So this woman comes from the back of the bus, and she says, yeah, he's telling you you're on the right bus.
Mm.
And so I sat down with her, and she says, what are you doing here in Glasgow? And I said, well, I'm from Canada, and I'm studying social enterprises. I'm trying to figure out the ecosystem that has created this amazing. Mm. And she knew, of course, what a social enterprise was. It's embedded there.
Yeah.
And she said to me just these few simple words, which are just a gift, I think. Is like, oh, they're so civilized, aren't they? They're so civilized. Well, it was the Scots who created the residential school system, really. The English had done it to them, so they figured they may as well carry those learnings over, you know, in a much worse way here in Canada. And so this business of social enterprise, it's civilized,
you
right?
know, if you could bring that expertise to City Hall, I mean, you and get people to understand that, you'd be a shoo-in. I mean, you know, and put that value to work.
What we need is just for everyone to do what's in their self-interest, what's in their own interest of their organization. So we sent the Winnipeg Police out 241,000 times last year.
Yep.
And it'll be another, you know, 5 or 7% increase this year. And so now we ask the question, we can have a conversation about more police or less police, but what I want to have a conversation around is how do we reduce that workload?
Yeah.
And it's ripe for disruption because the nonprofit sector can reduce that workload significantly.
Yeah, we take those folks and we use them in a way that they can be productive instead of having the police go.
Exactly. And guess who will like that the most is the police. Now, people are going to say, oh, you're so naive, and I've certainly heard this before, but it's a difference between telling them we're going to take 10% of your budget and we're going to just, you know, distribute it to the nonprofit sector. I love the idea of the transfer resources.
Yeah.
That's important, but we need to do this in a way that's actually going to happen. And I've been to Minneapolis. I've been to George Floyd Square. I could feel the rage embedded in that corner of the city. And they couldn't get a package through that was leaning into, we're just going to take a chunk of the police budget and transfer it over. And I think we're well beyond now being, you know, right about something. We've got to find ways that people are going to, that we're actually going to be able to make a difference.
Yeah.
And I think this is key. Now, something I haven't really talked much about is the gift of this procurement model is that if we had a list of people who were 100 people who are struggling with meth that are regularly involved with the police, they're not just involved with the police. They're also involved with the health system and the justice system.
Of course.
And so the nonprofit can get paid from all three systems. And that is how we can say we have what we need. It's just we're desperately in need of new ways of relating
when
to each
we
other.
When we spoke earlier, I didn't understand that part. Now I understand it.
Great.
I struggle with that. Now I understand what you're talking about and how it relates. And, you know, if we could, again, that exchange between nonprofits and the police is, I think it needs to be built. I totally agree with you that it needs to be built to a higher and more workable level, because right now it's pretty much non-existent.
Yeah, and we are coming out with a police modernization strategy as well.
Okay.
So I don't want to leave the impression that, you know, I think that the way we're policing is appropriate. There's much more effective, kinder ways. We need more, you know, diversity, and I'm not just talking gender and ethnicity. We need more diversity in skills. More social enterprise work. We need to, I don't want to give away what our announcement's going to be, but it's going to be very, we need to modernize policing, but a big chunk of it is financing. And as far as supportive housing goes, which I know your listeners are most interested in, we need to not talk to the police about supportive housing. We need to talk to the police about what supportive housing does, the impact that has on their system.
Oh, for sure.
And that's what's
reduces their workload. That's
absolutely
100% for sure, because the supportive part is the part that does it.
And yeah, I don't think 2,107 times last year that the police transferred a human being, a sister or brother
crazy.
Of ours, to the hospital.
Yeah.
They're experiencing a mental health crisis because they didn't have the supports.
Yep.
I'm done with that.
Yep.
I'm absolutely done with that. And to have two police officers sitting in the hospital waiting for that person to receive treatment and a cruiser car parked outside.
For hours
yeah.
and hours.
I think there's a better way of doing things.
Yeah for sure. And
they don't want to be there either, Al.
Oh, I'm sure they don't.
So.
We have about 5 minutes left, 4 minutes left, and I just want to just briefly talk on trends, and then have a couple announcements to make after that. But what would you change about transit right now?
We're going to be making our transit announcement shortly.
Mm-hmm. So you don't really want to...
No, I can tell you what we've already said, and that mm-hmm. is that we're going to create a new... We're going to supersize transit. We're mm-hmm. going to call it Metro Mobility. Mm-hmm. It is going to be an intermodal system. So right now we've got conversations about buses, mm-hmm. and we've got conversations about vehicles.
Right.
And buses do some things amazingly well, mm-hmm. and vehicles do some things amazingly well. We're going to connect the two okay. with one integrated, amalgamated fare, so that with oh. one touch of your iPhone or mm-hmm. a phone call mm-hmm. for people that don't have an iPhone,
yeah.
that an electric van that's wheelchair accessible
can nice.
come to your house yep. or within 250 meters is virtual bus stop,
right.
and can take you to the rapid transit station. And so we can let vehicles and vans, electric dynamic vans, do what they do well, flexible, mm-hmm. transfer a few people to a particular spot, and let buses do what they do well,
yeah.
which is transfer a lot of people
yeah.
to, you know, a one particular spot and to connect the two. So that's certainly a big part of it.
For sure. What about the violence on the buses?
We're going to have a separate safety strategy. We're very excited about mm-hmm. what we're proposing.
Okay.
And, I mean, it won't surprise you that the people who are causing problems on the buses, they do so over and over and
yeah.
over and over again. So
we spoke briefly on that earlier.
I am done just doing this, you know, let's arrest the guy, lock him up. It's not
yeah.
working. So when they're finished with their accountability measures, and I'm not suggesting we pull back from that, but mm-hmm. we should greet them with, you know what, my friend, you've got five options. Here's the first four.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't like those first four options, how about we work together in designing a fifth option
right.
that'll work for you?
Yeah.
But this bothering people on the bus, it's done.
Yeah.
And so that's an actual crime-fighting strategy. That's a safety strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And there'll be other measures as well, but we'll
Good.
Be leaning into them.
Oh, for sure. It was a pleasure having you on the air today. And for basically 1 minute, if you got one last thing you'd like to say to our audience and to the city.
Well, just encourage people to visit our website. We have a big, compassionate, creative thinking team, seanforwinnipeg.com. You'll see friendly faces there that have endorsed the campaign from all sectors of Winnipeg. And I just want to impress upon your listeners, we have an actual opportunity to change the course of the city. And I'm not talking same old, same
mm-hmm.
old. We're talking leaning into the gifts that we have here in this
mm-hmm.
city. We have so many gifts. Indigenous wisdom, a beautiful nonprofit sector with so much
mm-hmm.
built up, people looking for work that needs to be done. We have renewable electricity. We make electric buses, but we don't drive them.
Yeah.
The green jobs, all these things. We have what it takes, but we can't keep doing things the way we've been doing them. So seanforwinnipeg.com and lots of opportunities to engage with us there.
Yeah.
Really appreciate your time and hope we can connect again soon.
Yeah, thanks, Sean, and thanks for being on today.